Morning. This meeting of the House Education Committee will now come to order. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2019, and the time is 8:08 a.m. Members of House Education present are Representative Delana Johnson, Representative Tiffany Zilkuski, Representative Josh Rivak, and myself, co-chair, Representative Harriet Drummond. Representative Tuck and Representative Hopkins are excused. We have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, you know the drill about cell phones. Today, our recording secretary is Selman Holland, and Doug Bridges is our LIO moderator, assisting with tech and teleconferencing. On the agenda, we have completion of university land grant, followed by House Bill 128, teachers and national board certification. We'll start with House Joint Resolution 13, Representative Pruitt. We have staff presenting to you today. Staff presenting to you today. Solo, okay. You know what to do.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative 27 in East Anchorage. Thank you for taking the time to hear HJR 13. HJR 13 actually kind of came to light for me within the last couple of years as we've had conversations related to funding of the university. And as we were talking, I was talking with the president at one point in time. He relayed to me the challenge that they have. We always talk about the university being a land-grant university, but yet it has not received the full allotment of land that it should have received. I actually won't go into all the detail. Following up behind me will be Miles Baker from the university, who will have a slide presentation to go through some of the history, so I'll let him do that. But ultimately what happens here is because of the fact that we have not received our full allotment of land, we find ourselves at the largest state, but having only two other states that have less land allotted to them, one being Delaware, the other being Hawaii, that I believe from what I can tell may not have any actually allotted to it. And even Rhode Island has more land allotted to the university than the university system than we do here. Still to the university based on the initial history is around 360,000 acres. You can only imagine what 360,000 acres can do to help alleviate some of the challenges financially to the university. I kind of take the university and I compare it in terms of what we're talking about here with its ability to use its lands to what we've done with the Mental Health Trust, where every year they generate income that helps them be able to provide the services to their beneficiaries. Well, the land allotments that the university has could help us do that. The legislature's tried to deal with this. At times, we've tried to actually give the universities some land to help them. We did it in 2000 as well as in 2005. And the challenge that we come up across is that that becomes a dedication of land or a dedication of resources, something that we're not allowed to do according to the Constitution. In 2009, actually, the Supreme Court ruled that that was the case, that we were not legally allowed to give them some of the land allotments to help them generate income. So here we are looking again back to the federal government, requesting of the federal government that they assist us in giving the land that we times where it takes an act of Congress to make sure that our university system has the land that they need. So HJR 13 is our way of kind of sending that note, sending that message. We've heard many times from our federal delegation when they're here speaking to us, especially from as they come in and speak to us on the floor, we ask them, do resolutions matter? And they consistently say that resolutions matter. So this will be an opportunity for resolution to our federal delegation asking that they assist us and assist the state in getting an allotment of land that we were due from almost 200 years due from the federal government. With that, I will also let you know that we have Andy Harrington, who's the Associate General Counsel for the University. If you have any questions there. Property manager for the land management offices should also be on. I would questions,
questions from the members.
Representative Pruitt, I was just kind of flipping through trying to find, is this federal land that would be conveyed under this? If the congressional delegation was able to get an act of Congress, can you just describe where the land would come from and to what amount of land would be conveyed to the university?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And my understanding is it is federal land. I've tried in the past. Back to originated back when we were still a territory, but the initial acts that allow for land of education goes back to actually the 1860s, 1862 with the Merrill Act. So this would be federal land. It would be a small portion. Federal allotment that the state would get in general, but it would be federal land.
Okay, we're back on the record. Our phone callers are back on. Representative Pruitt, let's see. Any more questions from the committee members before we get started? Representative Johnson?
Yeah, I have a couple questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, please go ahead.
So I recall there's a number of other lands that haven't been conveyed. Do you have any, I mean, can you just speak to that as if you can, about how much other land is out there from the feds that haven't been conveyed? And if you don't know the specifics, I would understand that. I know there's some other things out there.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So the total state land grant is supposed to be somewhere around a little under 105,000 acres that we're supposed to receive. I know. I don't know the exact amount that we're due. We're due a substantial portion of that still. And I apologize that I don't have that actually in front of me. But, I think, and I understand, of course, right now that the current administration, along with the previous administrations, are actively working on trying to define what those lands are to see if we can accelerate getting those, receiving those from the federal government.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, it may be in your resolution, but how many other states are lacking in the federal conveyance? Do you know that?
Yeah, this, through the chair, Representative Johnson. So, actually, I believe that The majority of them actually have their federal land conveyance. What's kind of interesting is if you actually look at the other states and you see that you see the federal land that they have, in some cases, all of the federal land, especially on the East Coast, goes to the university systems, whether it's Pennsylvania, West Virginia, a fair number of them. That's a pretty sizable amount of them. But as you get farther to the west, you find that a lot smaller amount goes towards the university system. As things changed over time and the federal government held on to more land. So I believe that this is, ours changed, and again, I'm not trying to get into the presentation, but you know, the Statehood Act actually changed some of the previous law. We were intended to be given some back in the early 1900s, but the Statehood Act came in and basically changed that. And the way I like to attribute it, it's very similar to ANILCA. Some people will argue that with the Statehood Act we had some certain promises, but ANILCA actually changed some of those promises. The thing is that just because ANILCA changed, it doesn't mean that we can't go in and we can't request that the law change again. In this particular case, because of the understanding that we had when the university was initially established, based on the law at the time and what we were working under, just because the Statehood Act might make some changes doesn't mean that we can't go to the federal government and say, you know, this is, we are trying to create a university system that is world class, that has the means and the resources to be able to do what they need to educate and to provide the research for our students and actually for the nation, especially when it comes to Arctic research, that we shouldn't go back and ask for something similar to what we originally were under the understanding we would receive.
A lot more questions.
Go ahead. So, in your opinion, then it would now be a favorable time to make this happen? I mean, I don't know. I don't know the acting department. Secretary of Interior, obviously we know who Joe Balash is. It occurs to me this might be a good time to get this passed.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think it's a good time to get this passed for multiple reasons. One, I think you do have an administration that's more a little bit more favorable to some of Alaska's challenges. You also have two members of the U.S. Senate that represent Alaska that are in some key places. Representative Murkowski, of course, from her position as the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. But I think you have another thing, and that is you have our current fiscal challenges that open up the opportunity for us to have this conversation. You know, if the federal government is looking for financial concerns that they have, if you're looking for a mechanism to allow for states to be able to provide for themselves, this is a great opportunity. We're asking that they give us the ability to provide for students. I just read this morning, of course, you have a lot of different people that are running for president, and they're promising a lot of different things, whether it's free college, et cetera. Whatever the decision might be made, we want to educate our students, and the best way to be able to provide for more people being able to go and be educated, whatever the decision is, if they want to be educated through a four-year degree, or whether that's through some other maybe trade-type operation, it's much better to be able to say, give us the means and the resources, give us the lands, and we can provide that service, we can help educate those individuals, therefore relieving some of these challenges on the fiscal challenges that the federal government has. So our fiscal challenges should give us an opening and an opportunity to ask them to be able to help us provide for ourselves.
All right. Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any further questions from the committee? All right, let's get into the presentation. Then would Mr. Miles Baker please come forward? And we think we've got the PowerPoint queued up and ready to go. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know the drill. Put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed with the presentation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Miles Baker, I'm Associate Vice President of Government Relations for the University of Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity today to talk about the issue that underlines HJR 13, and that's the university's land grant. And I believe have on the phone today with me to help answer those questions and correct the record if I don't answer it correctly myself, Andy Harrington from the General Counsel's Office in Fairbanks, and Laura Carmack.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, great. So if I could, I've got a fairly short presentation here today, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of high-level background on the land grant, sort of our current thinking on a solution, and then a few slides about the land we do have and the revenues generated from that land. So as Representative Pruitt mentioned, the University of Alaska is a land-grant university, but of the 49 states that received college land grants, only Delaware received less acreage than Alaska. Hawaii was given cash in lieu of a land grant, and I believe in your packet, you have a seven-page history that goes into some great detail. I would encourage you to read that if you have time. I'm going to touch on some of the high points of that. But the last page of that, the attachment one, is actually a list of all the university land grants. You'll see the state, the grant itself, and then the total grant that state got from the federal government in totality, you know, for other things, and the percentage there. And so you'll see Alaska there at number 48. At the bottom, which for the largest state in the union is not where we'd like to be. But a land grant university, also called land grant college or land grant institution, is a higher education institution in the U.S. That's granted federal land for them to basically raise money, establish an endowment for higher education in every state. And college land grants originated in the Morrill Act of the late 1800s with basically the federal mission of developing the West, spreading the teaching of primarily at the time agriculture, science, engineering, and a response to the Industrial Revolution in a way to push westward expansion. Today, there are more than 70 land grant institutions around the country. However, under explicit terms that were included later in the Alaska Statehood Act, Alaska is the only state that wasn't extended those Morrill Act benefits. And the legislature has tried many times since to rectify that situation, and we haven't been able to. I will get into some of the reasons for that here in a moment. So you see there on slide 3 that we really have only received about 110,000 acres through that federal land grant entitlement, and believe that we're still due about 360,000 acres. Obviously, the land grant, I'm on page 4 now, the land grant would help provide a robust endowment for the state to generate income, a steady source of income, and over time moderate the money we get from the state general fund. We're going to touch on this in a minute, but the Fed's perspective is really that the university's land, the federal responsibility for providing that land was included in the Alaska Statehood Act. So at the time of the Alaska Statehood Act and the federal government's decision to provide the largest land grant they've ever provided to any state to Alaska at statehood, they explicitly discussed the fact that the state, that would then become an obligation of the state to ensure that the university got the land that up until that time they had not yet received. I won't go into a lot of the history here. You do, as I said, Andy Harrington, who's on the phone and who's the principal author there of that white paper you have in your package, goes into this much in much detail. But there were really three federal laws pre-statehood that you can go to determine what the entitlement was. As I mentioned, the first Morrill Act, which gave 30,000 acres per member of Congress to each state or territory once they became a state. When the Statehood Act went through, the Morrill Act, as it applies to Alaska, was revoked, and so that act was no longer applicable. The Wickersham Land Statute Act was another piece of legislation, 1915, that envisioned the University of Alaska getting acreage in the Tanana Valley area. That land remained unsurveyed, and just like many of the issues that the state of Alaska is dealing with and some of our native corporations are dealing with in terms of getting their final land selections, it was largely because so much of the state had been is remote, had not been surveyed, and so although this statute remained intact, we basically only ever received 5% of the land conveyed there. And then a separate act in 1929, Congress did grant specific to the university 100,000 acres. That is principally the land that we find the UAF campus on, and that was not affected by the Statehood Act, and that acreage is eventually conveyed to the UA and is principally the land we have today. Following
Mr. Baker,
yes.
Just so you know, Laura Carmack is back on the line in addition to Andy Harrington.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I think you've heard the sponsor as well as others say, that the legislature has certainly taken this head on several times. In fact, the first territorial legislature passed a bill in 1959 to reserve 1 million acres to the university. That legislation was later vetoed. In the 60s and the 80s, or through the 60s and the 80s, the land transfers, land issues in Alaska got much more complicated in advance of several of the major pieces of legislation that we're so familiar with, ANCSA and ANILCA. There were land freezes put on. The selection of land and prioritization given to those pieces of federal legislation, during the work up to the pipeline, several public land orders put in place by BLM, Department of Interior, in the 2000, the legislature tries again, passes a bill that was also vetoed. In 2004, the Supreme Court, as part of that veto, determined that a land conveyance is not an appropriation, so that the legislature had actually overridden that veto, but there was some discussion about whether it needed a three-quarter override or a two-third override if it was an appropriation bill. Supreme Court determined it was not, and in 2005, the legislature, through a separate piece of legislation, actually started to transfer specific pieces of land, and for some of you that may have been around then, that was a big bill that year, as all these pieces of actual pieces of land were laid out in the bill, and a lot of discussion. That legislation passed. There was a suit filed by the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, arguing that the land transfer was a violation of the dedication clause, the anti-dedication clause of the Constitution, which was not a question the Supreme Court had taken up previously. And you see there in 2009, the Supreme Court struck down both those pieces of legislation that would have transferred the land, and in essence said that no, the transfer of land to the university is a violation of the dedication clause, given the purpose of it was to raise dedicated funds for the university. So that's really the modern history of where we are today. And you see there we own about 151,000 acres. Most of them were from that Sutherland Act. We have received some private party donations as well as some local government land, local communities and such. So what we've been trying to do and working on since that 2009 Supreme Court decision is there is an exemption in that in the dedication clause that says that dedication in essence is allowed when required by the federal government for state participation in a federal program. So that is what we're currently working on with. We've, at least in the 2 years I've been with the university, working very diligently with the federal delegation to explore different options for how such a federal program might be created. The federal government's position is that the land exists for us, but that it is in the hands of the state, or will be in the hands of the state when the state completes its final land selection. So the state is due about 5 million acres from its original land grant entitlement from the or transfer from the Statehood Act. They have overselected another 5 million acres. There's another 10 million acres that are covered in these public land orders I mentioned. So there's about 20 million acres of potential land that's selected, not yet conveyed. There hasn't been agreement yet between BLM and the state on what those final 5 million acres would be. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at as part of this federal solution, is a combination. Is this land, you know, to go to the earlier question, the land is state land, but it may be a large portion of it may be state land that still had held by the feds due to the state and hasn't come to the state yet. And obviously there'd have to be an agreement. So what we're working on is between BLM, DNR, state, the university, is looking at those potential land selections, looking at what lands we may be able to come to agreement on that would be allowed to come into a UA land trust program that would be set up by the federal government. We believe it could be a robust program that also solves some of the outstanding administrative and other land issues that are affecting the final selection for the state. So we see this as sort of a potentially good impetus and a good a problem to be worked into that final solution with the state's own land selections. We've looked at whether there's a need for federal legislation. There may not be a need for that. It might be nice to sort of put a final bow on this, but we do believe that through the our current thought is that through the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, which is the federal act that governs how public lands are managed by BLM, and also some authorities that were included in ANILCA, that DOI may actually have the administrative authority to do these sorts of exchanges and corrections to conveyances that they could use to craft a federal program that would then allow us to do these transfers in a way that complies with the Constitution and at the same time satisfies our land deficit. Page 9 are just an overview, sort of where we are now with our land holdings. You'll see there the big gray missing estimate there. Of the land, we do have the 151,000 acres. You'll see it broken out into two categories. About 2% of what we think our total land should be, but you'll see a 12,000 acres is educational land, and that's land that includes the campuses, research sites, and other facilities that we base. In essence, we use to do the operations of the enterprise, if you will, where we have activities going on. And then another 139,000 acres, what we put in sort of investment class, and you'll see the basic breakouts there of the land by very broad categories. I would note at the bottom there that we do not have a significant amount of property that may be oil, gas, coal developable. We do have a little bit there, mining and material. We do some surface gravel sort of mining, but most of what we've done in the past is in the first two blocks of really developing real estate, residential subdivisions, commercial property. We do have some remote properties that have been sold, and we've had forest timber resources. Page 10 is sort of the historical receipts. You see there since about 1987, we have generated $220 million from what limited trust lands we do have. And last year, we successfully generated $10 million in gross receipts from real estate and resource development. We have a 20-year average of revenue in the $8.5 million category. So we don't, again, it's not a huge piece, and that's where we hope to be able to really improve on that if with our final land entitlement. Just a couple last slides, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman. This gives you sort of the history back to 87. That's that cumulative period I talked about, the $220 million. And you'll see the different receipts by revenue source category. And you see it's fairly sporadic, and it largely has depended on large land sales, building sales, or specific timber sales represented there in the green. So just as the state would like to, we'd love to smooth out that revenue stream through a permanent endowment and through managing of those lands in a way that brings us a consistent stream of revenue, royalties, and such. And then finally, here's our UA Land Trust balance. So this is the balance of the trust as of the end of last fiscal year. And it's sitting there at a little less than $160 million. And I would note that one of the big uses of the UA Land Trust funds is to fund the UA Scholars Program. So that's the program that funds scholarships to the University of Alaska for the top 10% of all high school graduates coming out of high school. And that's different than the Alaska Performance Scholarship Program, which is another important program. That one is financed out of the Higher Education Investment Fund. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions, or if there's some specific questions I can't answer, I would ask my colleagues that are on the line if they can answer those for you. And
all right, great. Thank you, Mr. Baker. I'd like the record to note that Representative Story joined us at about 8:25. Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative Zulkowski, first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Baker, for that overview and for all of the significant amount of information that was provided to us on the history of this. Slide 4 indicates monetizing, let me just find it, that the land endowment would help the university generate more revenue, and I just want to make sure that I understand slide 11 is, I just want to make sure that I understand how the land generates revenue. Is slide 11 an overview of how that land would be used to monetize resources for the university?
Through the chair, Representative, yes. This is a the pie chart is is the cumulative amount of revenue that's been generated since. Are you on slide 10? Yeah.
Yes.
So that's 221. million total, and by those categories. I think if you see on the left, generally that's how we've been, those are the ways we earn income, through real estate, sales, leases, easements, forest, timber sale has typically been. We've had a good chunk of the land that we do have has been in timbered properties in the Tongass. We have some rock and gravel extractions that we do, and then mining coal, oil, and gas. I think we would be looking, you know, working with DNR, we would really like the 300, you know, land sales are, can be good, but then they've left your portfolio and there's really no income after that. It's sort of a one-time hit. The timber work we've done has generated money, but it's a renewable resource to an extent. It's a very long lead time renewable resource. There is a timber sale that we're working on in Haines. It's the last relatively large parcel of timber that we have that's probably commercial, and this is second growth, so it was actually harvested originally pre-statehood, and so that it is possible. But I think we are certainly looking as going forward, what is the best way to have land that fits within the profile of the university and can generate money for us quickly and in ways that will be on an ongoing basis. So I think we would prefer to be doing mineral royalties, oil leasing, those sorts of things, property leases. Mm-hmm. But most of our property is remote. It's a very remote property that may not have huge commercial value or interest. So one of the things we're working on is with DNR in this latest effort is to potentially pull some of those remote wetland properties into wetland mitigation banks or carbon banks as another way to potentially develop revenue.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that explanation. I know it probably goes without saying, but since it's early Monday morning, I guess I will just say it. On slide 6, when it's kind of notated about the complicating factors of the land freeze and the passage of ANCSA and ANILCA, just to put on the record that ANCSA was a settlement of treaty obligations to Aboriginal land claims, which has, as a result, generated millions, if not billions, in revenue for the state and invested significantly in higher education. In just doing a bit of research on ANILCA, I understand that has it established essentially over 43 million acres of new national parklands in Alaska. And so what is the university's expectation potentially of impacts to other federal lands or land status in order to make sure that this land grant is conveyed? Is there going to be impacts to other federal lands in Alaska as a result of any potential acts of Congress?
Through the chair, Representative, I may kick this to Andy Harrington for his thoughts. I think we certainly understand. I mean, under the broader sort of feeling in Congress and within the federal land managers that probably no new federal land, no new additive federal land would come to Alaska through this program. So we don't anticipate the feds deciding that, you know, we should get 360,000 acres of federal land that exists in Alaska that it is not due to someone else already or to another organization. We do believe that there are things we have in our portfolio that are could be to the benefit of the federal government and the public at large, whether that's our park-in holdings. We've got several in holdings in national parks that sound great, but they're very remote, very hard to develop. It's a small market of folks that might even be interested in, but the federal government, I think, is interested in them and potentially being able to more effectively manage those national parks in a contiguous fashion. So we think there actually may be sort of mutual benefits there, but I think it will largely depend on what land we would end up negotiating with DNR. We anticipate that it's principally going to be state land or land owed to the state through their final 5 million settlement. But where those lands are and how they might impact other adjacent property owners, that sort of thing, I'm not sure we know yet. Mm-hmm. But Andy, do you have any comment there for Representative Sulkowski?
Mr. Harrington, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
And, go ahead, Mr. Harrington.
Through the chair, I would say that I think everything Mr.
Harrington
said was accurate, and we.
Excuse me, Mr. Harrington.
We're trying to keep this proposal simple. There's no attempt to try to, as we said, we think we can do it without federal legislation. We don't think that there's going to be any need to revisit anything that Congress has said in the past. The idea would be to try to get this land grant gap filled using as much as possible lands that are still due to the state, and we would be staying away from any areas where the state, where there may still be some kind of issue yet to be resolved with a native corporation or other controversial issues. We'd like to get this gap filled with non-controversial land. Thank you.
Mr. Harrington? Mr. Harrington, can you hear me?
Yes.
I need you to put
your... Can you not hear me?
I need you to put your name and affiliation on the record before you began your testimony. So if you do that now, it would be appreciated. Thank you.
Apologies through the chair. Yes, this is Andy Harrington. I'm Associate General Counsel with the University of Alaska.
Okay, thank you. All right, any questions for Mr. Harrington? Okay, seeing none. All right. Thank you. Mr. Baker, any additional questions for Mr. Baker from members of the committee? Representative Johnson.
Some of this is about the land transfer. Some is, thank you, Madam Chair, through some of it's just in general. So I'm looking at slide 11, where you talk about receipts by resource category. And it shows the UAF Ag Farm sale to Providence Health at $5.4 million, then the Trunk Road sale, $6.5 million. Those are two large pieces of agricultural land that was granted to the university by the federal government for the experimental farms and for agriculture, but yet they got sold as a, just because they're a high dollar piece of land, and the university still has a lot of land in that area. I guess what I'm trying to get to is there, is this, if you were going to get more federal lands, is it for university purposes or is it for investment purposes? So if you look at a portfolio and all lands are equal, I mean, there's a lot of land out there. I know in the Matsu Valley, the university owns, may get more, that if it's a resource just to sell, or is this a resource that you intend to use for either educational purposes or for resource development? And I guess in addition to that, I have another question as well. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think that I don't think it's too much of a leap to think about this as we do the permanent fund in terms of how we would like to manage it. It is a trust. It would be managed as a trust. All this land goes into a trust, so the receipts, anything we earn off of the real estate and the lands that are in the trust, go back to the trust, and then we pull money money off of that trust, operating monies off of that trust, to, you know, pay for the management of the trust, pay for the scholars program. We do pay for some programming relative to natural resource development, because we want there to be a very strong nexus between the resource economy that we're getting this revenue from and the educational programming, that explaining how all that works. And so these decisions, and Laura may have a comment, but I think in both those cases, this was land that we owned that was that the borough and the commercial industries out there were very interested in terms of being able to develop that road and develop the area, develop the hospital that's around where the ag farm is. So I think it's a balance. It's always going to be a balance. But clearly, if we sell the land, then we don't have it anymore. And we're trying to generate a perpetual, you know, a trust that goes in perpetuity. And so just like with the permanent fund, we've got to keep a principal balance that grows, and then also be able to pull off some money to augment the resources. I mean, ultimately, we're trying to bring down the our dependence on the general fund that we get from the state. I don't know if that – did that answer your question? Maybe Laura – but Laura might – Madam Chair may have some comments about those specific deals.
Would you – shall we have – will Ms. Carmack be able to help out on this? Laura Carmack, are you on the phone with us?
Hi, yes. This is Laura Carmack.
If you please put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed.
Yes, this is Laura Carmack, University of Alaska Senior Property Manager. What Miles did say is correct. We did sell those properties at the request to help with the industry need. But our focus now is not necessarily land sales, but more into resource development. The properties that we do own in the Matsu area now are mostly educational lands.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Thank you. So I guess that's what I'm trying to get to, is that there's a number of there's still buildings. There was the University of Alaska Fairbanks experimental farm or agricultural project piece. And it looks like all those buildings are just getting, emptied, and all the agricultural pieces being brought to Fairbanks, even though, you know, Matsu's the only place that has the best place to grow anything in any sense, and it was a thriving educational community at one time. I mean, the whole educational experimental piece. Do you anticipate those lands getting continued to be sold off? Those are high dollar, they're high value lands right there, and I know this isn't exactly about the federal land grant, but it does. I do want to get a sense of what the university's intent is with their land, if they're, and then I have some additional questions about mining and resource development.
Okay, you want to follow up, because we do have another bill to get onto, and we will be holding this bill over to another day, so we could continue. I have to comment, in the absence of our member from Fairbanks, the Fairbanks area was once entirely self-supporting through its own agriculture. I don't know the exact history, but I know our Fairbanks folks would love to comment on that. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Johnson, you have an additional follow-up question for Mr. Baker.
The Chair, Representative Johnson, I will certainly follow up on the specifics of what our short-term plans are for the experimental farm out there. It is part of the UAF extension program. I was out there actually just this fall, right before session started, getting a tour of that. And you're right, over time, that was a fairly big piece of property, and over time they have sold some of that off, primarily to accommodate the growth that's happened in the area and the transportation corridors and the Mat-Su Regional Hospital. But they do have classroom facilities there, and they're still doing stuff there. We have a joint lab we manage with DNR there, I believe. But I can get back to the committee on sort of where we're going with that.
Is that it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one other question.
Yes,
kind of off of that onto the so are you looking to sell your property that you have now, or are you looking to do, you know, like if you look at, like, as of 2005, obviously timber sales kind of dropped around then. But are you looking to do, you know, oil, gas, leasing, anything? What do you see you doing on university lands, I guess? And is it worth the potential to do more active resource development on your lands?
Representative, through the chair, we have, as part of this effort to address the 360,000-acre land gap, we are doing a review of all the land we currently do have in advance of sitting down with DNR. We're starting to have, in fact, this week, serious conversations about what land we might like from DNR. We have been through this in 2005 when the legislature looked to transfer specific pieces of land. So we have some starting points of land that was going to be transferred to the university. That's over 14 years ago. So we want to relook at that. The state is looking at their own 5 million selections, and there's a lot of thought process going into that, of what the most valuable, best use of that land would be. But I would say in general, we're interested probably in the same sort of land that the state is interested in terms of its ability to generate revenue. I mean, our primary focus is revenue generation. And so while you can generate some land by selling the land, I think our preference at this point is to maintain the land and to have land that has oil, gas, mineral mining potential.
Follow up?
One more question.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I mean, and I guess what I'm hoping to hear is that if you, you know, and obviously I'm a big supporter of getting your land transferred to you, all of Alaska lands that are should be transferred to us from the feds, I mean, that we were supposed to get, but that also, that the University of Alaska is, you know, going to work on making sure that the land that they have produces the income that can come, you know, as an active management to make sure that it produces as much income as possible from resource development or and so on.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Mr. Baker, I just want to say you mentioned what I think the extension service withdrawal from the South Central area back to Fairbanks is a sore point with South Central folks. Several years ago, I know that the extension services were essentially moved back to Fairbanks away from the 40 to 50% of the state's population located in South Central. And it might be worth taking a look at how those services continue to be delivered, because I know there is frustration about the extension services, but that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with this land transfer. So any more questions from the committee on this point? Representative Rivak, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Baker, through the chair. Are there other ways other than real estate sales that UA generates revenues through real estate? Is there commercial, residential, rent, lease?
Through the chair, there are. I might see if Ms. Carmack, is she still online?
Yes, Ms. Carmack,
you're
still on the line with us.
She probably has a better response than I can provide.
Ms. Carmack, did you hear the question? Laura Carmack, are you still on the line with us? You may need to unmute your phone. Please put your name and affiliation back on the record, and if you heard the question, go ahead and answer it.
Laura Carmack, University of Alaska, Senior Property Manager. I'll need you to repeat that question. I apologize. My connection is not very good.
Okay, Representative Rivak.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Ms. Carmack, through the chair, this is Representative Rivak. I am just curious. I'm looking at slide 11, and the blue bars reflect the revenues from real estate, and I was curious, are all those real estate sales, does UA generate revenues in different ways through real estate, commercial or residential or lease or rent? And
yes.
If so, how much of that, of the reflected on slide 11, is lands that UA retains?
I'm sorry, the connection is so bad I couldn't hear.
Are all the blue bars on slide 11 real estate sales?
Does Ms. Carmack have the PowerPoint, Mr. Baker?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So real estate sales, the University of Alaska, we do have real estate sales. I'm sorry if I'm not answering the question, and it's my connection's cutting in and out.
Ms. Carmack, I believe the question was, how does the university generate revenue from the real estate portion of your land trust?
Oh, thank you. Through the chair, the revenue generation for real estate comes from sales of university property, leasing, and permit activity.
Okay, Representative Rivak, follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Carmack. So how much of the real estate revenues are leasing and permit activity?
Ms. Carmack?
Right now, currently, that's a majority of our activity is permit activity and leasing. We do work with annual requests. Majority of the leasing that we have right now is through commercial office space leasing and some land leasing throughout the state.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Rivak.
Actually,
follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Could I get the percentage of revenues that our lands retained from real estate?
Just that number. We can get that information to you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from the committee? All right, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you for this information. I am wondering how this dovetails with land grants for K-12 public schools. I know they are trying to still, there's a movement to try and still get lands for K-12 too. And I am trying to remember, but one of the problems was not being able to survey. So much land is not surveyed. So I'm glad the university is going into this, but I'm wondering how we're working with the different partners who are all concerned about getting the land that they were entitled to.
Mr. Baker, would Mr. Parsons perhaps have a response to that? Marty Parsons is still on the line with us. He might know the answer.
Or Mr. Harrington, I'm not familiar with the status of the
Mr. Harrington
education.
Is off the line. He is on? Okay. It shows red on my screen here. Okay. Mr. Harrington, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am. Madam Chair, this is Andy Harrington, University of Alaska Associate General Counsel. Mr. Parsons may have a more complete answer than mine. Through the chair, it's correct that the public school land grants and the university land grants had their roots in the same legislation, the 1915 Wickersham Act, which set aside one section in each township in a big rectangle called the Tanana Valley rectangle, but then set aside two sections in each township throughout the entire territory for the public school lands. Since then, their histories have diverged significantly. The legislature passed in 1978 a law that changed all the public school sections into general land grants and gave the public schools a revenue stream, I think 0.5% of all revenue generated from resource development throughout the state. And while the University of Alaska was given that same option, it was made conditional on a decision, an acceptance by the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents decided not to accept it. So since 1978, those two histories have diverged significantly. Also, ANILCA in 1980 included an additional 75,000 acres of federal land specifically to try to fulfill the remaining school land trust, and the university land grant gap was not addressed in that. So that's how much I know, and Mr. Parsons may have more information about the current status of the public school land grant trust.
Mr. Harrington, is that detail here in the 7 or 8 page history of the land grant promise that we have in our packets?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think it does mention the initial 1915 Act and the 1978 legislation. After that, it probably doesn't provide current information about the public school land trust.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any additional questions for Mr. Harrington or Mr. Baker? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. I would like to now open public testimony on this issue. Public testimony is open. Is anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Joint Resolution 13? Anyone online? Seeing none, I will keep public testimony open in case folks want to participate with us next time we hear this bill. And seeing no further, no additional public testimony at this time, I'm going to hold this bill. Thank you very much, Representative Pruitt, and your support. Next up, we will continue our previous hearing of House Bill 128, Teachers and National Board Certification. If the bill sponsor and his staff would come up. And if there are any additional questions from the committee members. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead and put your names and affiliation on the record.
Jonathan Grace Tompkins, right. District 35.
Great. John Scanlon, Staff Rep Grace Tompkins.
Okay. That was, I was very excited about your presentation last time, and I'd like to get this moving forward. I wish we could attach money to it. From what you told us about what other states are doing is exceptionally intriguing to me, and it's a it's almost criminal that we're in that we're in the fiscal situation that we're in right now in terms of supporting teachers in their bid to become nationally certified and keep quality teachers in the state. Any additional questions from the committee members for these folks? Representative Story? No? No questions? Okay. Great. It is my intention to move this bill today. Representative Story.
Oh, comment first, please?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe we've had some, you've had some conversations about how to possibly get some funds for this program since we met last. Could you share an update on that?
For the record, John Scanlon, Staff Rep Grace Tompkins. Representative Story, we've had a few conversations with education advocates across the state about looking for paths to providing funding that don't require another bill or statute. I've also had a conversation with your staff exploring another idea, and we're not quite sure what that would look like, but we've been working on that.
Thank you.
All right.
That's important work. I look forward to that continuing.
All right. Very good. If there are no further comments or questions from the committee members, It's my intention to move this bill. Representative Story.
I move version 31-LS0812/M of House Bill 128 from the Education Committee with attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill passes. Let's sign the paperwork after we adjourn, as we're almost there. The next House Education meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, April 24th at 8:30 a.m. Note the time change, where we will meet jointly with the Senate Education Committee to hear from fiscal performance analyst Mark Foster about K-12 funding considerations. And with that, we are adjourned at 9:14 a.m.